They say the best things in life are free, but there's actually a secret deluxe tier of best that you can unlock for a few bucks a month. It's Patreon-exclusive Retronauts content, and that includes bonus podcasts every other Friday, weekly mini-episodes by Diamond Fight, Discord access, and more. Here's a quick look at our latest bonus episode, which you can listen to in its entirety by going to patreon.com/retronauts and subscribing at the $5 a month exclusive content tier.
This week on Retronauts, we are not GMO-free. Welcome to a particularly music-focused episode of Retronauts. I'm your host, Kevin Bunch. We're not going to be discussing a specific game soundtracks. I know usually that's what Jeremy does when he has these more musical-themed episodes. But in this case, we're delving into a very specific type of covers of video game music. Specifically, covers from the house bands that these video game companies would put out into the world to, you know, promote and record their own music. Before we delve too deep into that, I want to go around the room and introduce the folks I have with me. So let's start with our Japan correspondent.
Please. Daddy Milk is my father. My name is Diamond Milk. No, Diamond Fight, sorry.
Incredible. And who do we have over in the Midwest?
Hello, I'm Brian Clark from 1 Million Power, and I am here to shred.
We are definitely going to be getting into some real shred-heavy music out here. So yeah, we're talking about house bands, and I guess first we should probably identify what is a house band in the context of these game companies. So, you know, generally speaking, a house band, it's a band that plays at a specific company or recording studio, an establishment like a bar, that sort of thing. In this case, for video game companies, these usually, but not always, consisted of their game music composing staff. They would find the ones that could play instruments, which is usually a fair number of them, and they would set them to work into a band. This was pretty much just a Japan thing. I have not been able to turn up any indication that, you know, Midway or Atari or anyone did this sort of thing themselves. And I think the time period that this took place in, around 1987, 88 through the early 90s, it was really sort of the bubble economy years. And I feel like that might have been a factor in that. But,
you know, something else that happens a lot, I think, in the case of Japan versus America, is just like, Japan is such a centralized nation in general, mm-hmm. you know, and all these, most of these companies are either in Tokyo or Osaka. So it's like, if you get your staff together and you have a band, there's going to be like dozens of venues you can go to that'll probably draw enough crowd to make the whole thing worth it. Whereas like, if you're, you know, if you're a game developer company anywhere in America, like, unless you're in a really big town and you've got all your staff in one place and you know there's an audience for it, like, what are you going to do? Like, send them on the road? Like, that's going to cost a fortune.
Touring in America is a much more expensive proposition, to be sure.
Yeah, right. you could probably get away with, like, Chicago and New York and maybe California. And beyond that, you're boned.
Look, everyone, it's the Midway Band Tour Bus.
Here to play all your faves from NBA Jam.
The one song from NBA Jam.
You know, it's a great song.
I love that game, but it basically has one song.
Would their singer just be the announcer? Just not singing, but just announcing over a band playing that one song?
He would show up for that. He would show up for that. Yeah. You know, he would.
He absolutely would. I mean, he showed up to Midwest Gaming Classic that one year.
Did.
And he was willing to shout out for anyone who'd talk to him. So really, you just have to get someone to do some backing music.
He'd be set.
But anyway, I think another key factor is that Japan was really sort of on the ball with recognizing video game music is something of interest on its own and not just, I guess you'd say, is like a fad or I'm at a loss for words. I'm blanking. Come back to that.
I mean, yeah, if you look at the early 80s, you know, when video games really blew up in the US, there was, you know, as you said, a fad sort of air to it all. And then you had a lot of, you know, like the, was it Buckner and James, the Pac-Man Fever
album? Buckner and Garcia.
But probably one of those James, whatever. you know, they made that album of songs that are basically about video game music, and they sometimes try to imitate the sounds of the video game, but in often cases it was just like, hey, what rhymes with Defender? You know what I mean? So, whereas that around the same time, you had actual like hit musicians in Japan are like, hey, what if we try to arrange these songs? What if we try to arrange the sounds from the game into like music, you know? And they're probably not high doing this even. Like, that's just a crazy idea they had. What if we make the beeps and boops and make them into, you know, a Bach or something? And that's, you know, I'm sure Kevin's got some examples of that lined up for us, but I think that sort of kicked it off. And then really by the late 80s, you know, as soon as CDs start getting really big, it's like, oh, everything just has a CD now. And then throughout the 90s, as CDs, you know, explode in Japan, suddenly everything is a CD. Like, there are video games that probably didn't even sell well that you can find soundtrack CDs for, whereas, like, I feel like it would have taken probably another decade or so for a video game to really get a soundtrack album in the United States, and, like, it had to be, like, one of the biggest video games of all time, you know? Like Mortal Kombat got, like, CDs, and, like, then Killer Instinct had the Killer Cuts, which I still have here somewhere, but, like, those are really big productions that were obviously, like, reaching out for like huge things, whereas in Japan, again, it's like kind of the hobby scene. Like, well, if we, you know, we print this up and we'll sell them, you know, we sell a few hundred or a thousand copies, like, we're good. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, distribution's a lot easier, as we pointed out. Japan's small enough that kind of works.
And often these game companies would either have in-house labels already, or they would have like close affiliation with a record label. So it wasn't even like they were spinning up relationships or a new division just to even put these out. I think it was very easy and pretty low risk to just throw this stuff at the wall.
Yeah, they had relations. A lot of these were published through Pony Canyon. And before that, they published through the GMO label, which,
yeah,
going back to, you know, talking about how Japanese musicians really picked up on game music first. There was the super group, Yellow Magic Orchestra. And if I remember, their first album in what, 78 or thereabouts?
Yeah, 78, 79.
Yeah, it opened with, you know, the theme from The Circus, which is like, it's predominantly music from the XD arcade game Circus, which Taito had brought out in Japan, and it was fairly popular. But also it had all sorts of other sound effects going on from like game centers, and they arranged that into a song, and that led into like another song. It's really cool. It's one of their best known works. And, you know, in 1984, Haruomi Hosono, who was a member of Yellow Magic Orchestra and a, you know, prolific musician in his own right, he's still around. He's still quite active.
I think he's the last one, right?
He is the last one.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. 1984, he put out an album just called Video Game Music, which was a soundtrack album of video game tunes. And as far as I'm aware, it's the first album focused specifically on the music of video games. And subsequent to that, you know, he was a major push behind starting up the GMO music label, which would publish various game soundtracks, especially in the late 80s, which a lot of these house bands is where they got their start. You know, the Capcom and Konami and whatnot, Sega, they'd be putting out their own albums through GMO, and at some point they decided, hey, can we get arranged versions of these songs in there as well? So even some of these original soundtrack albums, they were attributed to these house bands. But it's really once they started doing these arranged tracks that I think they really came into their own. And sometimes they did live acts, which we'll get into a little bit as well. Not all of them did. There's a couple that did not, or just did like a couple of times that I've been able to turn up. But you know, some of these bands like Zuntat, SST band, Gamadelic, they were very prolific on the live circuit.
And for longer than you would think in most cases.
Yeah, like some of these bands, like almost all of these petered out in, you know, the mid to late 90s, but quite a few of them saw sort of resurgences in the 2010s, really, which we definitely need to delve into a bit.
If you enjoy what you hear, head over to patreon.com/retronauts and enjoy hundreds and hundreds of hours of exclusive content with more available every week. Your support makes this show possible.